MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
And it's that time of a Tuesday. We say good afternoon to Dr. Ross Walker. Hello, Dr. Ross.
G'day, mate. How are you going?
I'm all right. How are you?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Cheryl wants to know, I imagine you've heard of this. Have you heard of Crestor, C-R-E-S-T-O-R? Crestostat?
It's one of the most commonly prescribed drugs in the world. It's otherwise known as rosuvastatin, which is the strongest of the four statins. There is Crestor, Lipitor, Zocor, then Pravacol.
Right.
And I don't use Lipitor or Zocor. I only use Crestor or Pravacol because they're water-soluble. I don't like the fat-soluble statins. It's my own personal preference. And, in fact, my colleagues don't agree with me because Lipitor is the biggest prescribed drug in the world.
She wants to know, is it good for cholesterol?
Oh, of course it does. Look, there's no doubt that all statin drugs lower cholesterol, Crestor being the strongest. But the question is, do you need your cholesterol lowered? So all males at 50, all females at 60, I get the coronary calcium score, not the intravenous CT coronary angiogram, which is not a screening test for heart disease, although a lot of my colleagues think it is. There is not one scientific paper in the peer-reviewed literature to show any benefit from the intravenous CT angiogram over the calcium score. Now, what's the difference? Well, firstly, the CT angiogram makes your wallet $500 lighter, and you get nothing back on Medicare, which you don't get for the calcium score either. The calcium score is around $150, whereas the CT angiogram is much more expensive. It doesn't give you any more predictive value over the coronary calcium score, but what it does do is make you glow in the dark for a few days afterwards because it's a big dose of radiation in many cases, although some of the newer machines is less radiation. But you're also getting intravenous contrast that you can have an allergic reaction to, and there's always the potential for the contrast to damage the kidney. So I reserve the intravenous CT coronary angiogram for people who have symptoms, not as a screening test. So please, if anyone's listening here and you want to know whether you should or shouldn't be on a cholesterol-lowering pill, go and have a coronary calcium score if you're a male of around 50, a female around 60. If you're a 30, 40-year-old, you shouldn't be on statins anyhow unless you've got an extremely strong family history of heart disease.
The other difference between the two tests is one hurts and one doesn't.
Yeah, well, there's no injections with the coronary calcium score, but there is an injection with the CT angiogram.
Absolutely. There you are. There you go, Cheryl. That's your answer in a nutshell. Now, today we're talking about aspirin as a prevention for, well, as a prevention for what? For heart disease.
Yeah, look, the problem is there's been this, I think, misconception over the past 20, 30 years that once you hit 50, you should start taking a baby aspirin every day.
Mm-hmm.
And look, that will reduce your risk for a heart attack by around 25%.
Right.
But mind you, if your starting risk is 5%, that's not a particularly significant reduction. And the problem is that aspirin is not totally harmless. So even 100 milligrams of aspirin a day can cause issues. And I always tell the personal story of my mother. And my mother's no longer with us, but when she was alive, this was well over 10 years ago, she came down to visit. She used to live up in Ballina on the beautiful north coast of New South Wales, and I hadn't seen her for 9 months. And she came down to my house, and she was incredibly short of breath. So I took off my sun hat, my SON hat, and put on my doctor hat, ran some tests, and her hemoglobin, which is the red cell count, had dropped down by half. And I said, "Mum, any change in your bowel habit?" "No, son." "Notice any bleeding from anywhere?" "No, son." "Are you on any new medications?" "No, son." "Mum, do you take aspirin?" She said, "Oh, yes, son, I take aspirin." I said, "Mum, why do you take aspirin?" She said, "I read it was good for the heart."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Mum, you may have missed out on this, but I have been one of Australia's leading cardiologists for the last 25 years. You could have asked me." And she said, "Oh, I didn't want to bother you, son." I said, "Well, you're bothering me now, woman." So we got a gastroscopy, colonoscopy done on Mum, and she'd wiped out her stomach from taking aspirin.
Oh, really?
So we're not talking about a harmless drug.
Yeah.
And it's predicted that assessed that around 10% of people who take aspirin will get problems with gastrointestinal bleeding, peptic ulceration, bad reflux, etc. But for people who are at high risk for heart disease, so someone who's already had a heart attack, stent or a bypass, or has a very high calcium score, I tend to give them a baby aspirin every day. There is some reasonable evidence about reduction in some of the common cancers, particularly colonic cancers as well. But if you're a bleeder, don't go anywhere near it. And don't take it just because you think it might be a good idea. Discuss it with your doctor first. And this most recent research showed that there are over 6.5 million adults in the U.S. who were taking an aspirin every day purely because, like my mum, they read it was good for the heart, but they didn't even speak to their doctors about it.
If you're a relatively healthy male, female, you know, 55 and over, should you need to take an aspirin or not?
No. And these three studies that came out last year, three independent studies showed clearly there was no health benefit for otherwise healthy people taking an aspirin every day. That is not the same as if you've already had a heart attack, stent or a bypass. So this is just a healthy person wants to know, will aspirin give me any extra benefit? The answer is no.
And the other thing, and I put this forward because my dad was on this, who is no longer with us, but I mean, my dad was on warfarin, which is a blood thinning medication.
Yep.
And for people, you know, you can't take both warfarin and an aspirin. I mean,
you don't
do that.
There are situations where people are particularly ill where we might use both medications, but no one should ever be taking, say for example, they're on warfarin for some other reason.
Yeah.
They've had clots in their lungs or they've had a clot from atrial fibrillation or whatever. And then they get a bad headache and they take a couple of aspirin. That's a good way to wipe out your stomach.
Right.
Have severe gastrointestinal bleeding. So you never mix drugs or supplements or anything else without discussing it with an expert first. Always talk to your doctor about it. And there's a lot of blood thinners now on the market. And warfarin, for example, is more for venous clotting. Clotting in the low flow things like your veins and the atrium in the heart.
Okay.
Whereas aspirin's more platelet dependent, more for the arterial clotting.
All right. My dad used to call warfarin rat poison.
Yeah, look, it is the same stuff that's in Ratsac, but the different. It's like calling paracetamol poison as well. If you take two paracetamol for a headache, you take away a headache. If you take the whole box, it kills you. So it's calling it rat poison is a bit unfair because we give rats a lethal dose to kill them, whereas human beings are given a small dose of warfarin just to thin their blood a bit.
Why, when you take a warfarin or a blood-thinning medication, do you have to, you know, until you get used to it, do you have to have regular blood tests?
Oh, no, it's only warfarin. Warfarin is the strong blood thinner. Then there are three other newer blood thinners. So there's a drug called Xarelto, Pradaxa, and Eliquis. And these three ones, you don't need blood tests because they work in a different pathway to warfarin. But warfarin affects what we call the vitamin K pathways. And the vitamin K pathways are very dependent on this thing called INR, which is a measure of how thin your blood is.
That's right.
But with the other drugs, you don't need to bother. And with aspirin, you don't need to bother. It's just the warfarin you need the blood tests.
Paleo diet. I haven't read a lot about the paleo diet, but the paleo diet, is it bad for the heart or is
it
good for the heart?
Well, it appears that it may be. Now let me tell you, this is a great study. Australian study done in Western Australia and South Australia looked at 44 patients who are on the paleo diet and 47 are just on a typical Western diet. And 22 of the 44, now this is great, were on strict paleo, which is they have less than one serving per day of grains and dairy, and 22 patients were on pseudo-paleo, which I think is great. It's like being on a pseudo-gluten-free diet. One serving, they had more than one serving a day of grains and dairy, so I don't know how they call themselves paleo. So paleo is basically you'd have a very high intake of meats, fruits, vegetables, nuts and seeds, but no dairy or legumes, no grains.
Right.
So And they're saying they're simulating a caveman diet because the caveman didn't get heart disease. He certainly didn't, but he didn't live beyond about age 40 to get heart disease.
That's true.
It's a nonsense argument. And what they did was they measured a level in the bloodstream of a thing called TMAO, which is formed in the gut, a particular chemical with a combination of diet and certain gut bacteria. And it's argued that that when you reduce the carbs in the gut, that basically what happens is that you get a different type of bacteria. And there's no doubt that people who have a lot of fruit and vegetables have a different form of gut bacteria than people who don't have the fruit and vegetables. And the paleo people are arguing that their diet's very healthy for you. But unfortunately, it whacks up through the roof this level of TMAO, which is associated with heart disease. And so there's been no studies at all of something like the paleo diet to say whether it does or doesn't prevent heart disease. We haven't done a big enough study. In fact, the only diet in the world that you and I have spoken about on numerous occasions that has any long-term mortality, morbidity benefits, so reduction in death and heart attacks, is the Mediterranean diet.
Yeah.
And that's been shown beyond a doubt to reduce your risk for heart attack, cancer, dementia, chronic kidney disease, diabetes by about 30 to 50%. So forget about all these other fringe diets, which is what I call them. focus on the Mediterranean diet, which is pretty similar. Buckets of fruits and vegetables, little bits of meat, dairy, chicken, nuts, grains, olive oil. And that's the way we should be doing it. So when people say you shouldn't have dairy, you shouldn't have grains, there's no good evidence for it.
And I don't like to call that a diet. It's got to be a way of life.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I wrote a book 13 years ago called Diets Don't Work, because you go on a diet like you go on a holiday. What happens when you go on a holiday? You come home.
Exactly.
And most people stay on diets for about 3 months. They get sick of it and go back to their normal eating. So I think what you've got to do is develop a lifelong habit of eating good quality food and having good quality exercise. That's the way to be healthy.
Vitamin D, can it reduce diabetic risk?
Yeah, see, this has been the conjecture over the years about whether supplements are useless, and you and I speak about it all the time. Do vitamins just give you expensive urine, or do they help? Now, all the studies that have been done on vitamin D up to now have been done on people with very advanced diabetes, so really it's been a bit too little too late. So what they did in this particular study was they took 96 people who were either pre-diabetic or just with a very recent diagnosis of diabetes, and they gave half of them 5,000 units a day of vitamin D, which is a moderately high dose, and the other half they gave placebo, and they found significant improvement in what we call insulin sensitivity and beta cell function, which is where the insulin's made. No overall benefits in sugar, blood pressure, or weight, but very small study, not really powered to show those things. So it showed that if you can get onto these things early, vitamin D, it probably gives you a good benefit in reducing your progression to diabetes.
I like what it says at the end. Overall, this paper, though not large enough to cast the winning dice, forms part of an ongoing exploration of the role of vitamin D in diabetes. We will have to wait for more studies to roll in before we can confirm or deny that vitamin D supplementation might help manage or reduce the risk of diabetes.
Yeah, and so like most things, it'll be put in the bottom drawer and ignored. And I think personally, if people really want to look at good health, it's not taking supplements. Good health, the five keys of being healthy, which we speak about all the time. You cannot be healthy and have any addictions. You need good quality sleep. I watched a TED talk the other day, which I'd advise everyone to watch. It's Sleep, the New Superpower. Nutrition, which is basically eat less and eat more naturally, the Mediterranean diet. 3 to 5 hours every week of moderate exercise, and the best drug on the planet, of course, being happiness. But that's 80% of your management. The other 20% is the appropriate use of pharmaceutical medications if necessary, and also supplements. And I think all people over the age of 50 should be taking a multivitamin every day and some form of omega-3 like fish or krill oil. I think once you hit 50, you should be taking the Bergamet Pro Plus twice a day, that I always have to say I have an association with. And then if you've got other conditions, there are other supplements that work very well as well. And I think keep your vitamin D levels up to about 100. And the problem is that a third of the population have vitamin D levels less than 50, and they were the ones in this study who really had the enormous benefit from getting their vitamin D levels up to where they were.
Ross, how important is water, drinking water?
I think not getting thirsty is important. I think overdosing with water is not a good idea. A lot of people are walking around with low sodium levels because they've diluted the sodium in their blood from too much water. So I think that the whole nonsense comment about you must have 8 extra glasses of water per day, there's not one shred of science behind that. But equally, especially for older people, hydration status is really important. I say to my patients, especially my older patients, get a set of scales, a good reliable set of scales, wake up every morning, pass urine, and then stand as naked as you can on the scales and get an idea of what your weight is every day. Not because of fat, not interested in that. I'm interested in how much your fluid status is, and the weight is a very good indication of your daily fluid status. And so if you say, let's say somebody's 70 kilos,
yeah,
and they find that their weight's gone up to 74 kilos over a couple of days, that can only be fluid.
Right.
They're getting too much fluid on board, pull it back.
Okay, good advice. You always give us good advice. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you for your time, as always. We'll look forward to seeing you next Tuesday.
Talk to you then, mate. Thank you.
Have a good week. Bye-bye.